Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Come again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
So about 2 days ago now, Tim Vickery wrote a piece, Why Sampaoli is Barcelona's number one target. This is a story about Jorge Sampaoli. I'm trying to guess how Tim is actually going to pronounce his name. Mm-hmm. Is going to be the next Barcelona coach. And that was before the big news that has broken this evening that Luis Enrique is stepping down / leaving the club at the end of the season. So we'll deal with that a little bit later on in the show. Going to talk about Liverpool as well because, well, they're not so good at the moment.
Well, it's not good, to say the least. They've lost 5 of their last 7 in all competitions. They play Arsenal at the weekend. Manchester United are just a point behind them in 6th. Manchester United have been waiting for this for quite some time. They've been going about their business, winning games, back on form and stuck in 6th regardless. And now finally, they're about to overtake someone and it turns out it's going to be Liverpool. And maybe the most disappointing aspect of the defeat to Leicester from a Liverpool point of view is that they had a 16-day break and they were in La Manga and it was perfect preparation. And everybody from Gary Neville to various contributors we spoke to, it was of the opinion that we would see the Liverpool of the first third of the season here and they would get back to that, you know, playing once a week, gegenpressing brilliance. And they came out and it was terrible. It was flat and it was Lucas playing at centre half and they played a high line against Leicester of all teams. And suddenly they're about to drop into 6th.
They play Arsenal at 5:30 on Saturday. That game is at Anfield. But before that, Manchester United have Bournemouth at home at 12:30. So Man United could actually technically be ahead of both Arsenal and Liverpool. Mm. So drawing that game and they're pretty happy. But who knows what's going to happen. Talk about that a little bit later on. But we also want to talk about a story in today's Telegraph. Aston Villa have been warned over bullying young players. Now, this is actually a relatively serious story involving Kevin McDonald, who was Ireland's manager / coach for a little while. In some of the details here, in 2012, Villa were granted Category 1 status under the league's Elite Player Performance Plan, which is exactly what all the categories or all the academies strive to be. So held up is like an absolutely amazing, important part of world football. Mm. And the Premier League have apparently invested an absolutely huge amount of money in making this the case. Now, league officials are expected to have a regular presence in the club over the coming months to assess the club's progress with implementing a bunch of actions that they've been asked to implement after a complaint was made about Kevin McDonald. His alleged conduct was passed to the Football Association for consideration. Among the accusations made against McDonald, a former interim first team manager, are emotional bullying and shaming of players in front of teammates, alienation from the group, which was interpreted as a form of punishment, personal insults and abusive language on a daily basis, and players being told to F off inside to their faces when they asked to stay behind to do extra training. Poor leadership and coaching are also alleged. And apparently the players received help and support from an organisation called the Players Trust. Mm. Keith Andrews is on the line.
Evening, lads. How are we?
How you doing?
Good. Yeah, yourself?
This kind of sounds like a... I'm not talking about this case in particular, but this that type of thing sounds like fairly run-of-the-mill at, I don't know, in every sports film we've ever seen, and you kind of would have assumed was still going on in modern day football, but obviously it's frowned upon these days.
Yeah, I don't think so. I was trying to jaw a little bit off of there a few minutes ago. I don't think it is as prevalent as certainly it once was. I think it's very much coincided with a society change. You know, these type of languages, these type of behaviours, and if they are accurate in terms of the accusations that have been thrown at Kevin McDonald, then he's bang out of order. But I'm a little bit stuck in between here because I do think the society change and then the coaching change, the whole approach to it, we're not doing the players, we're not preparing them enough in a lot of cases for a professional career in football because it's not going to be plain sailing. So it will be a test of character. But those accusations, that they're not right. There's no place for those in football. But at times, you have to test individuals, their character, how they react to certain situations, as well as the obvious tactical, technical, all the physical aspects that you need to play a professional sport.
How do you mimic those instances? Like, is it game time or is it actually, like, Because there's two sides to that. There's being psychologically prepared and then there's being able to prepare or to be able to perform under pressure. And they're obviously very close, but like dealing with setbacks and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think, well, that's what you're not told. You know, everything's playing sale, and I say this a lot to our younger players when they go to England. If you're playing week in, week out, and you continue that kind of momentum that you've probably had since a schoolboy at your local club, at your bigger club, maybe you've gone to in Dublin, one of the big boys, and everything's great. You go over there, as soon as you get your first injury, or as soon as, oh, they've signed the lad from, depending on what level you're playing at now in England, they've signed the lad from Brazil, and he's going up against you in your position, he's taking your place. This is a very new feeling for a young player. And then you bounce on and you get 23 as football. And when I went over, I got schooled by players. So older players, people like Keith Curl and Steve Bull, Steve Sedgley. It wasn't so much the coaches. The coaches were hard, and there has been a drastic change in the style of coaching over the last 20 years, for instance. And I'm still learning that style. I have to be honest, I really struggled towards the end of my playing career with the change in footballers and how I was speaking to players on the pitch and then what was then acceptable. You know, you couldn't set the demands. You've seen Roy Keane in his pomp, the way he reacted on a pitch. That was the norm. Obviously, he took it to extremes in certain cases, but that was the norm in terms of dressing rooms environments. But in the last, say, I would say 5 to 10 years, there's been a huge change in that, and it's just no longer acceptable now. And I think the vast majority has been has been implemented by the coaches and the managers, not so much the players. The players have just followed along with this.
Mm. There must be an acceptable form of hard, though, surely.
Yeah, I think it very much depends on the club. You spoke about Category 1 academies. They are scrutinised to, like, it's like everything is on them. You know, they have to do things right. And this kind of, as soon as bullying gets thrown at them, they have to take these instances very, very seriously. If you go to a Cat 2, Cat 3, you know, there's not as much paperwork, for instance, for the coaches to fill in. I know for a fact coaches at Cat 1 academies, 2/3 of their time is taken up by paperwork, and it's very, very difficult for certainly former players to have to deal with that one. They feel maybe that they want to be on the grass,
yeah.
They want to be developing the characters of these players, and they get told you can only do one session a day and it all has to be logged. But
and sorry to interrupt, Keith.
Go ahead.
How do you differentiate between Cat 1 and Cat 2? What on what basis is that done?
I don't know the exact ins and outs, but it's certainly the facilities that the club have. It has to be all singing, all dancing. It has to have a 4G pitch, for instance. They have to have, you know, so many pitches for all the academies. So it's very much down to finances. So you'll find certainly the vast majority of Premier League clubs, a few of the big boys in the Championship, Villas, obviously Brighton is another one that has the Cat 1. But there is more leeway with Cat 2, Cat 3. So, for instance, the club I was previously at was MK Dons, that was Cat 3. The running costs are a lot lower.
Mm.
And you've got a lot more leeway in terms of how you run your club. It's very stipulated to when you're a Cat 1 club.
Take Neil Warnock in action in the dressing room, the halftime Neil Warnock rant, because that's one we're all familiar with.
Yeah.
Is that now unacceptable, a bunch of 16-year-olds?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I've learned as well as a coach, because, as a young coach.
Because you're a hothead. And
can be, yes.
Yeah, okay, you can. But that's the environment you grew up in. That's the environment you're familiar with. You stink the joint out in the first half. You're waiting for that Neil Warnock half time. But there'll still be managers at senior level who do that, no?
Yes, there will, yeah. But I think what you'll find, though, is, Joe, that it's lower that you go down. And if you're dealing with players, it's swung towards player power now. So let's just touch on the younger players, for instance. There's no way, categorically, you can speak to players like that. It's just a no-no, because you don't know what effect it's going to have on them. But certainly, senior football, I think there's times when you can, you know, now it's kind of a common phrase in football, you can only get that reaction 2, 3, 4 times out of the season when you know, the teapots are going flying around the dressing room, that type of behaviour.
Mm.
But as the years have gone by, you see it very, very rarely. And the Neil Warnock type manager, I think, for instance, what you've seen last year, maybe at Rotherham when he kept them up, it's a short-term fix. I don't think you can manage a club in a way like that that's going to be a long-term, because you can only get that reaction out of the players for a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of think back, Phil Thompson apparently did that role at Liverpool while the manager managed. There's also that story about, was it Pat Rice being told to shut up by Wenger? You can't talk to the players like that. That whole category, that whole ranking of them. Presumably it's the Premier League who actually is the accrediting body, or the FA, one or the other. But I guess if you're a parent, you want your kids to go to a Cat 1, and there's a general assumption that there is a duty of care and that therefore your children will be safe going to this club. That's kind of the context of the background to this story as well, that obviously English football is very self-conscious at the moment about making sure that child protection issues are all looked after, and that, you know, there's just this sense of openness and transparency about what they're doing.
Yeah, very much so, Jay. I'm kind of reliving the whole experience now again, from doing it when I was a 15-year-old to now I'm experiencing all these lads that I'm coaching at 15, 16, 17, going through the exact same experience that I went through, and I can just see the difficulty in how they're dealing with it. And, you know, you see their parents sometimes at the games, and it's the torment that they must be going through. Knowing it's a lot easier now, obviously, with Facebook and whatever, social media, they can get in touch a lot easier to fly over. But still, like, they're letting their young lads go away, so they have to know that they're going to be safe and looked after. And I totally agree with that. But then there's also an element of, and I'm not trying it at all, the Cat 1s, and I don't want to generalise them, but say, for instance, he's not technically good enough to be playing in a Cat 1 team. He's not good enough to play in Arsenal's first team. They'll still coach him until the day he leaves Arsenal to play in Arsenal's first team. Or maybe they have to get him ready to go and play at Charlton or Barnet or come back to League of Ireland, when certainly the style of play and the attributes needed will be very, very different.
Mm. And no part of you thinks it's gone too far? I don't want to sound terribly old school, because, you know, I think it is wrong if 15, 16 year olds are feeling threatened, and I can imagine what it's like, terrifying it must be to be in a dressing room and have an adult who has this power over you screaming at you. But is there a point where you're creating, to use, you know, the awful cliche, soft pampered, mentally weak, you know, these are kind of the old school terms that would be thrown. Is there some balance there? Is there some need for you to be able to have a go at players?
I still think so, yes. The way I would do it now was towards the end of my career as a player, and certainly I brought it into my coaching career, was I was very honest, and I still am very honest with the players. But you obviously have to word it in a very, very different way than maybe I did 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
But you still, 15, 16 is still a very, very young age. It's very much about development, and there's different ways of learning. Now we're in an era where, you know, there's video analysis, there's feedback, there's group meetings. Yeah. Back then, it was just motivational. It was just dictatorial. It was just screaming in your face.
It doesn't really work, though, does it?
No, like, it doesn't.
That's the thing.
You're right.
Like, and it's also, it breeds a culture of fear. You're not going to make mistakes. And if you don't make mistakes at that age, you're never going to learn.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I'll tell you what I will say. Go back to when I was playing it with the senior pros in training, even before I made my debut. They got you into good habits, because they wouldn't accept sloppiness in training. If you gave the ball away, they were on your case. Whereas now, I think we're in an era where it's just a pat on the back. Oh, don't worry about that. That's fine. Well, what about when you go and play in front of 30,000 fans? Or what about when the media are judging you?
Yeah.
So you have to develop this thick skin.
Because you're going to get it from someone.
Yes, and you have to. And you have to be able to deal with it, because you're going to have to if you're going to have a career in football. So it's then, who does it? Is it the coach? Does the coach implement it through his senior players in the dressing room? But again, it's just that getting that balance right. Because you're right, you can't have players, certainly at that young age, fearful in training, because you're never going to get the best out of them.
Mm. No, I agree with you.
Is it prevalent at a lot of clubs, or is this such a, it's a story today in the Telegraph because it's such an outlier?
Yeah, I was surprised to happen at that type of club, and it's too easy to say just because he's an older style coach, it's the way he does it. I don't know. In my experience, I haven't experienced anything like that as a player, certainly towards the end of my career, and as a coach as well. And I don't want to generalise, but I would imagine this type of thing goes on in lower league footballs. There's different rules for it. So, for instance, there's another difference as well, as between Cat 1, you know, there's no cleaning boots. That's gone away with the Indians. Whereas in Cat 2, Cat 3, there's still that kind of apprenticeship type role. So you go and play reserve team football the way it was, it's 23s now, then you don't have to clean the boots anymore. Whereas Cat 1, there's absolutely none of that going on.
Where would you send a relative or a son to give them the best chance of making it as a professional footballer?
I still don't think. I'm more well-rounded in my opinion now in terms of what I was even a year ago, because I've sample now, been back and seeing what League of Ireland's all about, the new 15, 17, 19 leagues, I still don't think there's a right or wrong answer in terms of going at 16 or going at 18, 19, 20.
Sorry, I meant Cat 1 or Cat 2 or 3.
Again, Cat 2, Cat 3, you're going to probably get in the first team better. Cat 1, you'll probably get a better footballing education, but you still have to have that cap on you where if I do have to go to a Cat 2, Cat 3 or go on loan to a League 1, League 2 team, your attitude has to be right. You can't get sucked into being, I'm an Arsenal type player, I'm a Man United type player, because you're not. You're a Man United U team player. Very, very different than being a Man United first team player.
Yeah. Well, we have a clip of himself to say goodbye to you on.
Look at me while I'm talking. The second goal. The first goal. You in soft as shit. You're letting him back into it all day, you. And no, I'm him. You're in Latvia. We're third in the league and we've got 2,000 fans getting pissed on over there. And we ain't got as much passion.
Did you have any managers like that?
Well, we used to play against him, funny enough, quite often when he was Sheffield United manager. We were vying for promotion and we had some horrible scenes up against him. I don't like him. Some of the stuff I heard him shout from the bench. I've heard him shout from the bench, break his legs about one of my mates. So he's not a person that would I'm endeared to. So that doesn't surprise me. But no, I'd never really had it to that level. I had it more. I keep going back to the senior players who ran dressing rooms.
If you'd heard that, right, and apparently other footballers have heard it too, surely the referee hears it, right?
Yeah, well, funny enough, it was the early part of my career. I was on the bench when I heard that, so he wasn't too far from me.
Right.
But yeah, it sums him up, you know, in the terms of the stuff that goes on in the tunnel, in and around the dugout, when you know, stuff he's shouting on. So yeah, that's probably the tip of the iceberg what you've just probably played there.
That's grim.
Yeah, sad, isn't it?
All right.
But it has changed. I go back to it. Football's has changed. I do genuinely think this is, you know, a small, small part of it, certainly from what I've experienced. And I would certainly emphasise that to parents that are out there worried about their kids going, oh, I think the vast majority of coaches, the structures that are in place are very, very good.
Mm.
Keith, great stuff. Thanks.
Thanks, Keith. Great
stuff. Thanks, lads. See you
soon.
That's pretty interesting. I hadn't actually heard that before about Warnock.
Had.
Break his legs.
Yeah.
Wow. That's grim.
Not good. But it was... not to defend that, right? Not to defend that. And to use a Trumpian defence. I don't think he means it literally. I think he's screaming it on to intimidate the opposition. It's a mindset. As opposed... I think if one of his players actually broke a leg, I do think even Warnock would say, what the hell did you do that for? Now... making that
maybe,
defense for him,
maybe.
I would like to think that. I think that's worth saying. The man's not here.
I was with you up until that point. I was like, okay. I get the point that it's to set a tone and a mood, but
yeah.
I think maybe he's kind of he did it. Didn't expect that, or you see, I don't know. The words have consequences. That's kind of coming back to the Rory thing earlier.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I don't think it should be shouted to anyone.
10 minutes left to go. Sergio Aguero has scored 4-1. Man City coasting against Huddersfield in the FA Cup this evening. Now let's talk about Liverpool. We've got Chris Bascombe, the Merseyside reporter for the Daily Telegraph, on the line. We were just looking at some of the stats about how the team have performed over the last while. Their goals have dried up, their wins have dried up, the goals conceded figure is up, their shot conversion rate is way down. Things have gone horribly, horribly wrong for them recently.
Yeah, apart from that, it's all right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds, the way you're going through the stats there, it just sums it up, doesn't it? I think, personally, I don't think they've really hit the great height since November, really, early November. Coutinho got injured, and then since then, they've just never, they've always been missing something. Coutinho, Lallana were out for a bit, Mane then went away, then it's Henderson out. And it's almost like if one element of that side isn't there, the rest just doesn't function. And that's a pretty worrying situation to be. And, you know, Henderson's not likely to be back for the weekend either. So I just don't think the squad is anywhere near where it needs to be. And maybe it's been overrated a little bit, unfortunately.
Is that probably the key point when we're trying to assess Klopp? Like, I'm seeing comparisons with Rodgers this week after 56 matches. They have the same number of points, and these kind of things are being thrown at them. But
well,
really,
Rodgers
had Luis Suarez and
Steven Gerrard. Yeah, and Jamie Carragher, the fish, as well, you know.
So isn't the reality that actually you look at the individuals and you look at the other five teams vying in that top six at the moment from Manchester United up, how many of those individuals in the Liverpool team would actually get into the first team of the other five teams?
That's right, but I mean, it's a recurring problem. I think the problem with the Rodgers era was they were probably better, you know, certainly that year when they went for the title, they were good at flat-track bullies, but Rodgers couldn't win the bigger games, you know. You know, when he got to semi-finals, or I don't know whether he actually won any of the you know, the recognised top six away from home. Whereas Klopp's record against the top six, that mini-league, he's top. So it's the other way around. Mm. But I mean, my theory is it's like they're just not world-class. They haven't got world-class players. You know, you look at, you know, they've got good players. They've got good Premier League players. But what separates the good from the really great players who, you know, I remember years ago Phil Thompson saying something to me, and he's spot on. You know, over a 10-game period, your top-class players will play well in 9 of those games. They'll have an off day now and again. But the great players, they play well 9 in 10. Now, what Liverpool have got players at the moment who play well 1 every 6, you know, unless it's a big, you know, it's Man United or Chelsea, and they raise the game. You know, look at the Southampton game the other day. You know, Southampton were the better team. Southampton are mid-table. What did that tell you? They've got good players, but they're not top draw players because they don't produce it week in, week out. Like the greats of the game. Mm. And in a way, we all overhype Liverpool because they're a massive club. So when Liverpool win a big game, it's back page, it's double page spread, it's a few days follow-ups.
Yeah.
But, you know, can they handle that? Are these players up to it? And at the moment, you'd have to say they're not.
Those shortcomings were very understandable for much of January when the squad was stretched so thinly. Maybe the reason we decided to talk to you this evening is that this comes in the back of that performance on Monday night where they had 16 days of a break. They were over in La Manga. We thought it would be back to an energetic, gegenpressing, brilliant Liverpool that we saw for parts of the early stages of the season. And yet, I mean, it was really worryingly poor, and you had Lucas there at centre-half and they're playing this high line against Leicester, and it's actually a massive low point in their season.
Well, yeah, again, and I think the ones that, you know, I've seen it before with managers. Fortunately, Liverpool feel as though I'm in a bit of a loop where that they come in and they have these ideals and they think they can apply what, you know, what Benitez did with Spain, who they had France, Klopp with Germany. And then after the year, they kind of realise, well, actually, I've got to change a little bit. You know, and to be fair, Julier got it right for a couple of years. Benitez, we know, got it right, particularly in Europe for a while. And now I think Klopp is going to have learned to view valuable lessons himself. And I suspect and believe he's probably learned the hard way that actually he's going to have to do things a little bit differently and get some more players in and adapt his tactics a little as well. Because I think what stood out to me on Monday was the lack of physicality. They just got bullied in the first few minutes. You know, a tackle by Jamie Vardy puts Mane out of the game without actually leaving the pitch for another hour. And there was just timid kind of tippy-tappy football, which just they never got themselves going. And it's just not, you know, it's never going to work in the Premier League. You've got to be able to do what Chelsea do, which stand up physically as well as technically. They've got world-class players, but they'll never be bullied if they're not on top form.
What kind of players and how many are you talking about? Because we started by talking about how their squad isn't really good enough.
Well, it depends, doesn't it, on what my fear will be that maybe they'll, you know, because they've still got a budget, will be that they'll end up just spreading it out again. You know, you get 7 to 8, you know, mid-range players who they'll develop, and they'll have the bodies if, you know, they're in Europe, in the Europa League or whatever, or even if they do get top four, which I think is less likely now. And then it'll just be the same again, you know. They won't be able to sustain it in all competitions. If you ask me what I'd rather Liverpool did, I'd rather they went and targeted 2 to 3 top-class international footballers, players who are in the Germany team or the Spain team or the Italy team or the Argentine team, and just said, OK, we might not have the resources to compete across all four competitions next year, but we're going to focus on that league title, or we're going to focus on, you know, competing, getting ourselves 70 to 80 points again and getting in the top four and develop it, evolve it that way. Because, you know, my fear is we'll just be just focus on, okay, we've got to have a squad to compete in four. And there's no point in competing in four competitions if you can't win four competitions. Just focus on the ones that you really want to do well in. And you know, Liverpool's greatest signings over the last 20 years. It's not really, isn't rocket science. Luis Suarez was a World Cup semi-finalist. You know, I know not many others took him, but he was there, you know. Xabi Alonso was a Spain international. Fernando Torres was a Spanish international. Javier Mascherano was the Argentine captain, even though West Ham couldn't seem to do anything with him. But, you know, Dietmar Hamann, German international. These were the great signings. Not many of the others where they tried to take risks have come off. And I think that's what Liverpool have got to do. They've got to use their name of Liverpool to mean something, not just competing for players who Southampton or Leicester or the likes could sign. You know, it's like Liverpool have given up. They can't compete with Man City and Chelsea financially, so let's not bother going for the kind of players they'll go for.
It also, it feels a little bit like they overreact to a relatively small sample size. Like, Adam Lallana gets this massive new contract, and people rave about his performances over the space of a couple of months. But like, is Adam Lallana really the foundation block for a new empire?
Well, I think they've got a lot of good support acts. You know, I think they've got players who would you know, be elevated by some world class players around them. You know, I think Lallana has been one of Liverpool's players, but I know what you mean. It's like players like Lallana and Coutinho. I mean, I wrote the other week, Liverpool haven't got a world class player, and people are saying, you're joking, Coutinho's world class. How can he be world class if he's not, as I said earlier, producing at 9 games in 10 in the way, you know, Diego Costa or Eden Hazard is doing at the moment for Chelsea? He's got to elevate himself to get to that level. And, you know, when they had Luis Suarez there, you saw the difference Suarez made, because as soon as he went, it just went, you know, he went from nearly winning the title to 7th or 8th place. That's what yeah. You know, you can have a catalyst. And so that's why I say it might only actually need 1, 2, or 3 players of that level. Mm. And it's not that easy you found, don't get me wrong, but I do think you have to start looking at players who you feel there's less risk, and the less risk players are more expensive.
Chris, one last point on that. So Liverpool announced losses of almost £20 million in the last year. And they've pointed out themselves that they're the only club in the Deloitte top 10 that wasn't in the Champions League last season. Mm. They're not, you know, let's take it they're not in the Champions League next season the way this season is shaping up. They've appointed a new CEO, Peter Moore, who's worked at Microsoft and EA Sports, and he's come in just this month. So financially, can they go after even 2, 3 world-class players?
Well, I think they've definitely got the money. If you look at the money they've spent, I mean, FSG get accused of not spending money. They've spent tremendous amounts of money. It's just not been spent particularly well, and I don't, in my opinion. You know, you go back to when they, you know, they had Cannoli looking after the purse strings. He spent 35 on Carroll, 25 on Stuart Downing. Now, you know, would he have been better just buying one player for 60 million? Well, of course he would have been, but that's not the way they want to go about it. That's a strategy.
Yeah.
Similarly with the Suarez money, they spent every penny of the Suarez money, 75 million. But they spread it out, didn't they? They bought 7 players, and I think of those 7 players, there's only Lallana, who you would say is actually first, you know, one of those who starts every week.
Yeah.
So the recruitment has not been up to scratch, and partly because of the strategy they've gone down. And I think just have to come down, you've got to try something else. You know, I think Liverpool consistently go for good players and then walk away from the deal because, you know, somebody else has bid a bit more. Well, maybe they're going to have to be a bit more stronger than that and go, well, look, if you want that player in PSG, you're in for him, or City, you're in for him. I mean, you're just going to have to pay that more to get the play, because money talks.
Yeah.
It's all very well managers saying, we don't want players, we only want money. Well, in that case, you know, welcome to, you better get in the real world. Yeah. Now.
Who's actually making those decisions on signing? Who's got the final decision now?
Well, it's definitely Klopp. I mean, definitely, you know, not just like to play this game now, doesn't he? But, you know, he had as much to do with it as any, you know. I mean, you know, this idea that it was just like some kind of mythical committee behind the scenes who were just telling the managers, nonsense, never being that way. And it certainly isn't with Klopp. Klopp will only get a player he wants, and he will be, you know, bringing his own names to the table, and he'll be deciding. But, he, you know, he'll have a certain budget, and he's going to have to decide, does he want to buy, you know, say, for example, if he had, I don't know, 60, 70 million, I don't think I'd put an exact figure on that, but, you know, hypothetically, would he want to buy, you know, 6 players for 10 million each, or would he want to buy 2 players for 30 million? That'll be a decision for him to make. I mean, I think it's going to be fascinating actually to see how he goes about it now, because I do get one or two little signs. I think there's one or two signals there that maybe he's realised that all these comments he made about, oh, you know, we've got the base here, we've got the players here already. He doesn't need much. I think maybe there'll be more to it than that now. I think he may have been a bit of a wake-up call for him on Monday.
All right, Chris, great stuff. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Chris.
No problem at all.
Chris Bascom there of the Telegraph. Paul says the fundamental problem with Liverpool is they can't defend. Club has not improved the defence in any way. Surely that should be the starting point. No structure to the defence, he says again, just in case we missed it.
Weird with Lucas playing. I know Clavin's not amazing, but on the bench. There's like Manchester United post-Ferguson did what Liverpool do, which is buy the likes of Blind and Darmian and don't get much better. And almost realised post Van Gaal, well, let's just pay 80 million quid for Pogba. Let's
see what happens.
Get some three or four world class players in.
Yeah, you can see them spending 100 million on a single player every year for the next 3 or 4 years.
It's a much better investment.
So, just that money that they got for Suarez, they bought Balotelli for 16 million, Ricky Lambert for 4 million, Lazar Markovic for 20 million, who looked good last week on loan at Hull. Alberto Moreno for 12 million.
Yes, that's the point. The Moreno is, you know, the pointless buy.
Emre Can for 10 million.
Not a bad buy.
Divock Origi for 10 million. Adam Lallana for 25 million. Dejan Lovren for 20 million.
So they're going to go Pogba.
Yeah. Or maybe, yeah. Yeah. They could have got somebody.
Yeah.
Antoine Griezmann.
Antoine Griezmann, exactly. And nearly won the league with just Suarez.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We're back talking with Tim Vickery about who is potentially the new Barcelona boss.
Off the Ball.
Home of live Premier League every Sunday from midday.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
Tim Vickery, good evening to you.
Hello, very good evening, gentlemen. How are you doing?
You are a prescient man. 2 or 3 days ago, you filed a piece why Sampaoli is Barcelona's number one target. This is even before the entire world knew that Luis Enrique was officially leaving, which we found out tonight.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't have the winner of tomorrow's 3:30 from Newmarket.
You can tell us a bit about Sampaoli instead to make up for that.
Well, first, I think it's a big decision for Barcelona, isn't it? Who comes next? We're at such a fascinating moment. I remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about cycles in European club football and how, you know, Guardiola had implanted a model of play there where the team kept possession and passed between the lines of the opposition, and the opposition responded by closing the lines a little bit. So Barcelona responded by signing Luis Suarez, who's so good on the shoulder of the last defender because that's where the space was. Well, the risk of that is an unbalanced team, isn't it? And that's what we saw against Paris Saint-Germain in that first leg, that 4-0 win. And Paris Saint-Germain pressed Barcelona high and managed to snap Barcelona into different teams. So, the neck bone had no relation to the ankle bone. And where usually, in their heyday, Barcelona always outnumbered the opposition at the point where the ball was, this time around, Barcelona were themselves outnumbered. So it's a big decision that they have to make in terms of how do they respond. And decisions with personnel as well. And do Piqué and Busquets, these old stalwarts, do they still have such an important role to play? So it'll be very interesting to see which direction they go in. But perhaps the most interesting direction that might be on offer to them, especially since Marcelo Bielsa has just signed a deal with Lille in France next year, perhaps the most interesting direction would be little Jorge Sampaoli, the Argentine, so successful with Chile, who is now having a splendid season with Sevilla. So that, I think, is something that the football world will wait up for. I've seen a lot of people in Spain saying that he is the number one choice, although some who know Barcelona well are saying that the club will be looking for a coach perhaps with more knowledge of the club. But if Sampaoli gets the job, you won't be able to take your eyes off him or his team.
He's a fiery character.
Well, he certainly is. I mean, it's my favourite story about him. Right at the start of his career, coaching what would be our equivalent of non-league football in the region of Argentina where he grew up, he got himself suspended, and he's always getting himself suspended. And when he's on the touchline, he is... He's a horrible little man in some ways. He's a horrible little bald figure who kind of wanders up and down the touchline like a little dog that's working on batteries. And he spends a lot of the time just yelping away at the referee. I've never seen a coach sent to the stands as much as Sampaoli. Well, in this instance, minor game in Argentina, I don't think there were any stands to go to. So he was sent off. So what did he do? He wandered out of the ground, climbed a tree, and watched the rest of the game from up a tree. You might have seen last week when his Sevilla side met Leicester in the Champions League.
Yeah.
Really could have been home and dry by half time. And 2-1 ended up not being a result that really reflected, especially the first hour of play. But he wasn't on the touchline for that one because he'd been sent off for previous misdemeanours. So he was up in the stands, you know, behind a kind of glass shield. And there were times when the camera went to him and you could see him, his little legs kicking away at the glass shield. So he wasn't really happy being constrained there. And we will shortly find out in the next few months if this man who once climbed a tree to watch his team, just how far he can climb now.
He's 5'7½". According to his Wikipedia
That's
page.
Important.
And don't you forget that half.
He edited himself.
Yeah. So, like his style of play then, talk to us about that.
Well, he's very much a disciple of Marcelo Bielsa. He comes from a similar region of Argentina. He even wrote to Bielsa before he knew him, apologising for being unable to put Bielsa's principles into practice. What does that mean? It means that he wants to play at a furious pace, at a furious tempo in your half of the field. It's a commitment to non-stop attack. He wants possession of the ball. He wants to throw players forward. He wants both of his fullbacks forward at the same time. He wants his width high up the field. He wants to create two against one situations in the opposing half of the field. He wants the man on the ball to have a great deal of options. It's high tempo. It's exhilarating. There is, I think, one question still to be asked about him. We are about to approach that stage of the season when it will be asked. Now, his mentor, Bielsa, has coached in Europe before with Athletic Bilbao and with Marseille and done well, but done much, much better in the start and the middle of the season than at the end. And there is a fear that this model of play burns the players out. It's a model of play, it's adapted in some ways from the Dutch school, but it's a model of play that Bielsa and his acolytes have developed in South America, where the club season is usually much shorter. So far, certainly for Bielsa, the European club season has looked a little bit long, and his European club sides have run out of steam long before the end of the campaign. Now we're getting to the business end of the season, with Sevilla in contention for the Spanish title and for the Champions League. Will they have enough gas to get their team over the line? Perhaps Barcelona will be watching that one closely over the next few weeks.
They're going to be watching the Bernabeu tonight very closely as well, because Kevin Prince-Boateng has just skinned Marcelo and Keylor Navas to put Las Palmas 3-1 up. Real Madrid are down to 10 men. Gareth Bale sent off. Just going to try and get some details on what he was sent off for. But so the style of play that you're talking about, let's assume that somehow he manages to work out conditioning levels to a point where they're actually going to be okay for the duration of the full season. Is it the type of thing that would be acceptable to the Barcelona hierarchy and to their fans? And I guess part of the big decision that's going to happen around the next manager will be, is this person amenable to the Messi empire? Like, do the Messi family decide they want to stay with this guy?
That's surely someone who you'd imagine they would be consulting now. You know, who do you want, Lionel? It is a model of play which the Barcelona fans and the club, I think, would like very much. Remember, Guardiola, before he took the job, one of the people that he went to talk to was Marcelo Bielsa. Guardiola himself last week referred to Bielsa as the best coach in the world. Well, Sampaoli is, I think, perhaps the number one Bielsa disciple. I think he's also shown that he can be a little bit more flexible. And Bielsa sometimes has had almost an adolescent compulsion to attack under all circumstances. When Sampaoli was coach of Chile and they finally won a trophy against Messi's Argentina on home ground, the Copa America in 2015, Sampaoli used his most dynamic midfielder, Charles Arangues, rather than driving forward as he usually would. He used Arangues to do a job on Messi, to separate Messi from his teammates. So Messi has seen that. Messi has seen what Sampaoli is capable of doing. They come from a similar region of Argentina. You'd imagine that Messi would be amenable to this as well. If so, that might well be at least half of the race run for Jorge Sampaoli.
Tim, is anyone not a Marcelo Bielsa disciple?
I think we can exclude Mr. Mourinho from that one.
Yes,
it is
really extraordinary, though.
Yes, it is. I mean, Bielsa's importance comes much, much less from any titles that he's won, and much, much more from people that he's influenced. And I think it comes back to one of the perennial truths about football that the cynical school always wants us to forget. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. You know, so often people in football say, well, no one ever remembers who comes second. It's an absolute lie. It's absolute rubbish. And everyone remembers Hungary in 54, Holland in 74, Brazil in 82. And Bielsa's teams, they've tended, I think, to leave a good impression, not so much for not always for what they've done, but certainly for the way that they've done it.
Great stuff, Tim.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Just getting the details of Bale was sent off. The Las Palmas player got away from him. He had a nibble at his heels. The referee was coming in to give him a yellow. Las Palmas player turned to Bale. Bale shoved him for two yellows in the space of 8 seconds or so.
I saw the shove.
Yeah?
It was tame.
Right.
And below the nipple.
I kind of don't think this is good for Ireland. I mean, I just think him having another rest, having come back now.
That's a crucial point, Tom, below the nipple.
What conversation have I stumbled into?
Below the nipple.
As a matter of fact, there was that, and there was a nibble at his heels as well. It all sounds very erotic.
Nibbles and nipples, yes. That's all you get here.
What are you watching? Love a video you're watching, lads?
Real Madrid, Las Palmas.
Okay. I believe you. Found a session I played last night at the show from Jenny Lewis, and it was only when I was playing, which I remembered how sensational it is. Jonathan Rice, their boyfriend, I think he's the guitar player and singer on a fair bit of it, to be honest. Brilliant. I was just amazed at how good it was. So I'm going to play more from that tonight. Fiona Regan's comeback single is brilliant.
What was the reaction?
Brilliant.
Was there a good reaction to it?
Yeah, thumbs up, you know. Yeah. Yeah, people never really jump up and down and decide to write to the radio station anymore. You know, those days are kind of gone.
That's true.
It takes a while. I find it's like trying to get somebody's attention. It kind of call them a few times and then they say, what's that thing you keep playing to me?
Months later.
Yeah. Happen. But it's really, really good. And music from Elbow and our new friend Ryan Adams and... I found a Damien Rice session as well, but it has Lisa singing Cannonball.
Where?
Oh. Yeah, from beginning to end. I have millions of sessions. I kept them all.
Is this a Today FM?
I have this archive. Yeah.
Is it a Today FM session?
Well, I'd call it a Tom Dunn session.
I remember you interviewing Damien Rice a good few years ago now on Today FM.
Yeah.
And he was talking about trying to set up his own festival where it wouldn't be all about drink and getting off your face of like healthy food, you know. And this was before this was all very fashionable. This,
for the picnic, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was before that.
Yeah.
Now it obviously never happened.
No,
but
it's good though.
It's a good idea.
It's good he wants to do it. Yeah, he's gone very quiet, hasn't he? I haven't heard a single whisper about him now.
It's the way it goes. With him.
He made so much money. I know we shouldn't bring it back to money. It's all about the art.
Yeah,
but he really did. He, you know, he took those songs, he wrote them himself, he recorded them himself, he did the artwork himself. Mm. So when he was finally giving a record to the record label, he was able to ask, I think it was, the quoted figure I heard was €5 a copy.
Nice.
Yep, and that sold multiples of millions around the world. So
well, fair play to
him. It's not often an artist can tell you a story like that, you know. So
no.
It's great stuff, really is.
We've got to take a break, but it sounds like a good show coming up. Thanks, mate.
Off the Ball.
Home of Wednesday Night Rugby with Woody and Jerry.
On News Talk 106 to 108.
Okay, so on tomorrow night's show, Kev is back in studio. We're going to have John Giles too. We're going to play the highlights of the morning that we spent out at trainer Gordon Elliott's yard. Graham Hunter's on the football show. I guess we'll be talking about Barcelona. And we're also going to chase the story that has become our Moby Dick, our white whale. You've got 24 hours to hunt down somebody who can talk to us about that Dennis Bergkamp goal against Newcastle in 2002. But earlier tonight, we asked you to identify our mystery voice.
I don't know if it's possible or not possible. Maybe it's possible.
That is Jose Mourinho. So congratulations to David Corrigan, who wins a pair of VIP tickets to Cage Warriors 81, which is on at the 3 Arena this Saturday. If you missed out, don't worry. We'll give you another chance to win tomorrow night. That's pretty much all we've got time for, unless you've got like a 10-second story that you want to talk
about. Yeah, Luis Enrique has just given an interview and said, I need a rest.
Because he's knackered the way Pep was knackered.
It's that club.
It's a pretty
dealing with Messi.
Stressful gig. I think there's a really good chance Messi leaves now because of this. And actually, that might be pretty interesting for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's stuff to talk about on tomorrow night's show. Tom Dunn is up next. Good night.
Give him a ball and a yard of grass. He'll give you a move for the perfect pass. Give him a ball and a yard of space. He'll give you a move with godly grace. Ra-ta-ta.